and listen for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played songs that made the hit parade. Guys like us, we had it made. Those were the days. Didn't need no welfare states. Everybody pulled his weight. Gee, our old LaSalle ran great. Those were the days. And you knew who you were then. Girls were girls and men were men. Mister, we could use a man like Herbert Hoover again. People seemed to be content. $50 paid the rent. Freaks were in a circus tent. Those were the days. Take a little Sunday spin. Tonight I'll watch the Dodgers win. Have yourself a dandy day that cost you under a fin. Hair was short and skirts were long. Kate Smith really sung the song. I just don't know what went wrong. Those were the days. I was actually looking for the lyrics of the other song by the same title, Those Were the Days. But I saw Archie Bunker in the search results and decided to switch off to this one. You know, All in the Family was a really fun show. It broke a lot of barriers in the TV world. Well, in the 60s, we broke a lot of barriers in just about every aspect of life. And they've been busy putting them back up ever since. They're sneaky. They tell us they're doing things to protect us, yet they're the ones that we need the protection from. They tell us it's for our own good, and we eat it right up and ask for more. Archie Bunker would fit right in today. Meathead, not so much. Oh, well. As Rosanna Dana always used to say, it's always something. Here in Fort Lauderdale, they're supposed to be resuming enforcement of the ban on sharing food. The date I heard for the first arrests, February 14th, Valentine's Day. The city is so nice that way. The mayor's up for re-election along with the council. There's some opposition, but it's likely to be business as usual. Same mayor and same council, since the business people are so much in support of the anti-homeless pro-money stuff that these folks keep pushing through. Now, some of us are trying to push for the fresh blood, and who knows? Could happen. Closer to home, I think I solved at least one of the technical problems that plagued us last week, and I hope you'll be able to hear the guests better as a result. We appreciate you, our listeners. We believe in what we're bringing to you on the New American Dream Radio Show, and that's why we keep on doing it, streaming to you live every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It would be great if you visit the network and make a donation or buy something. Hey, maybe a CD of all of our shows from last year. But in any case, you've heard enough from me just now. I'm Chuck Gregory, and I'm proud to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. I will welcome special guest
Mike, I'm not hearing you very well, and I'm gonna hang up and call you back.
Okay.
Wait, I heard that better. Try.
Okay. Well, what I was saying, can you hear that?
I can hear you now. Yep, go for it.
Okay, tonight we're welcome special guests, Phil Ferruccio, Sherwood Ross, Ava Bird, and Mickey Zesma. So tonight we are gathering for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Port Orange, Berkeley, California, Coral Gables, Astoria, Queens, New York City, and wherever you are. I want to pass this along, some must-see stuff, or must-listen stuff, I should say. Nick Collerstrom and Jim Fetzer on the Real Deal Radio Show talking about Charlie Hebdo and the Holocaust. Jay Wheatner and Jim Fetzer also on the Real Deal Radio Show talking about the fake moon landings and no planes hit the WTC. And Kevin Barrett interviews author Rebecca Roth on No Lies Radio. Go to No Lies and the Kevin Barrett Archives button. And as always, listen to the False Flag Weekly News, Kevin Barrett and Jim Fetzer on No Lies Radio. Well, the Oscar Award-nominated movie American Sniper will be a part of the cultural landscape for a few weeks yet, until it forever joins Karate Dog, Hot Tub Time Machine, and Caddyshack 3 on the bottom shelf of the movie rental section of the Chips and Gas in Coon Hat, Georgia. Here are some comments on the movie I found that you won't find on Good Morning America for some reason. The film American Sniper has sent the U.S. public into raptures over the heroic life of its autobiographical subject, Chris Kyle, who has been described as America's greatest warrior soldier. Last week, the movie premiered in cinemas to rave reviews, earning its director, Clint Eastwood, a box office smash hit. Multiple Oscar awards are nominated. Critics have quibbled about this or that aspect of the cinematography and storyline, but the prevailing impression is that Kyle, a U.S. Marine marksman, was a tragic hero, a guy who honorably served his country during the American War in Iraq. The film has even been described by some as an anti-war movie because it delves into the mental trauma of veterans and the suffering they endure after conflict. Lost in the discussion is the central issue, which is the criminal nature of American militarism and its destructive impact on millions of innocent people. American Sniper may express certain misgivings about U.S. foreign wars owing to the psychological consequences on its military personnel, but in indulging heroes like Chris Kyle, the insidious effect is to glorify American war making. This reinforces American narcissism about its exceptionalism as a nation that is intrinsically good, superior, and which has the prerogative to wage wars wherever it deems necessary for its national interest, regardless of international law or morality. Over 1 million Iraqis were killed during American military occupation of that country from 2003 to 2011. The fraudulent pretext for that war, Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction, has been amply documented and is irrefutable. That makes U.S. involvement in Iraq an epic crime, a war of aggression, or to put it plainly, a state-sponsored terrorist cataclysm. American government leaders and Pentagon commanders, including incumbent President Barack Obama, should be prosecuted for war crimes based on legal standards established at the Nuremberg trials for the Nazi Reich. Astoundingly, the power of American propaganda and brainwashing, facilitated by its corporate media, erases any awareness or discussion of this central issue. We have again received word from Randall from Stevens Point. He has made his way from the Ukraine to Ferguson, to the Sydney Chocolate Shop, to the Canadian Parliament, to the Kosher Deli in Paris, to the Hollywood Hills. He is now positioned flat on his stomach behind a Hollywood sign in the Santa Monica Mountains, overlooking Hollywood, Los Angeles, sighting down the barrel of his granddaddy's 30-06.
Got my gun in my truck. Told you, I'm heading for the woods and up the mountain. It's where I am right now. I can see y'all from right here through my scope. Don't worry, I got the safety on. It's on now. Tell Bubba Gina I always loved her. Don't follow me. I got on my camo socks. You'd never find me. When you hear about the big shootout, all well, that'll be me. Before he gets started with his standard ultimatum document manifesto, he wanted us to again relay this message. First, I got something to say to my relatives in Baraboo. I'm really not talking to any of you. Well, you know why. Randall's note continues. where are the calls for justice over America's state-sponsored criminality and genocide of the Iraqi people? Where is there even a semblance of remorse or reparation? American politicians continue to swan around the world, sanctimoniously lecturing others as if they were the epitome of virtue. Legal justice may be absent, but nevertheless, there's a very real form of justice for America's systematic iniquity. The American war machine may appear to trundle on, untrammeled by international law, illegally occupying countries, assassinating with aerial drones on a weekly basis, and subverting foreign nations by covert proxy terrorism, as in Syria and Ukraine. But unequivocally, this war machine is killing its own society financially, psychologically, and morally. Chris Kyle is eulogized as America's deadliest sniper, having killed single-handedly over 200 people during his 4 tours of duty in Iraq. It doesn't matter if most of his victims were terrorists or if he was serving in good faith to protect the lives of other American soldiers. The fact is that Kyle was a cog in a criminal war machine that was engaged in destroying a whole nation. For Americans to celebrate him as a warrior hero is indicative of the moral corruption that U.S. society has descended into. It shows how much that violence has become endemic in the American psyche. Kyle was shot dead at a Texas shooting range in 2013. His alleged killer, Eddie Ray Routh, also a veteran, was said to be suffering from post-traumatic syndrome. Well, Kyle, who declared his own post-conflict trauma after he was honorably discharged from the Marine Corps in 2009, was working as a counselor for other mentally disturbed U.S. vets. It says something about American social pathology that victims of conflict trauma are treated with therapy by letting them fire off assault rifles at shooting ranges. Every day, some 20 U.S. military veterans commit suicide, most of them wrecked by mental breakdown. That's over 7,000 deaths each year. Tens of thousands of other veterans from Iraq, Afghanistan, and other overseas American killing fields are reckoned to be silent victims of post-conflict trauma, committing acts of violence and crimes against other citizens, or degenerating into self-destructive lives of alcohol and other drug abuse. Similar numbers of American families are ruined by dysfunctional veterans who can't readjust into normal society. The economic cost of U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan alone is put at $6 trillion, or a third of America's crippling national debt pile. But a proper accounting reveals a much greater toll when the full social damage of these wars is assimilated. Medical bills, unemployment, crime, personal breakdown, unproductive members of society are just the tip of the iceberg. In real but intangible magnitude, American society is sitting on a massive, dirty time bomb from its criminal warmongering. This is the justice for U.S. wars of apparent impunity. The violence and destruction that American leaders have unleashed are unleashing on countries around the world, are coming back to haunt and corrode American society to its core. Killing millions of people remotely in far-off villages and deserts is exacting a righteous revenge on American society. The story of Chris Kyle is not just a story about an ill-fated American sniper. It is a metaphor for America as a whole. Part of this destruction and what makes it so profoundly terminal is that the American public is largely oblivious to its own collapse. When mass murder of humans is hailed by popcorn-munching morons as heroic, it is a sure sign that America is doomed fatally.
Our first guest of the evening is Ava Byrd. Ava Byrd is a poet and activist in Berkeley, California. And today is, I think we started this radio show on February 4th of 2011. So today is our fourth anniversary for the New American Dream Radio Show. And if I remember right, Ava Byrd was on that first show. And as it turns out, it's just very cool to have her on again today on the fourth anniversary. And Chuck will queue up her interview right about now. Ava Byrd in Berkeley.
Hi, Chuck.
Hello, Ava. Welcome back to the New American Dream Radio Show. And Mike was just pointing out that this is our fourth anniversary show. And you were on the very first one. So welcome back. You're on the air.
Wow. Thank you so much. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on the show. And it's you've had quite a run for 4 years. That's pretty amazing. And congratulations. And I'm happy to be part of the anniversary show.
Well, thank you. So just take it away.
Okay. Well, again, I just want to say congratulations to you and Mike and for everybody that you've had on the show over the years. And you always produce a good show, lots of humor, lots of good stuff, and ultimately the truth, which is what we need in these times. So let's see. I have some poems that I'd like to share, and I've got some. You tell me what you'd like to hear first. I've got some Zen poetry, and then also some of my usual stuff. So I thought I'd share both, and I'll start with the Zen poetry. That's all right.
That sounds good. I was going to suggest it.
Okay. So this is my new series that I'm writing. I've been reading a lot of kind of classical Japanese and Chinese poetry that was inspired by years and centuries of meditation and, you know, being in monasteries in the mountains and stuff. So I started to write my own, being in the monastery of Los Angeles, California. Okay. So I'll just go through. They're really short. They're haiku. They're not exactly haikus, but they're haiku-like. So there's several of them, and I'll just go through and read a bunch of them. Like strangers in the day, coincidental meeting, we in blissful moments, a horse and I share suddenly a summer sunset and smile. Here come the white people, ghost town, asking for signatures. Hot yoga teacher, have a beautiful day, walks quickly off into the sunshine. Massage therapist, how does that feel? Good. Dark theater, funny film, distracting beams, cold fluorescent light, screams, emergency exit. The lion cage between me pushing stroller, all of us dreaming of more. The street preacher screams, screeches, I speed away to evening meditation. Thank you. I live here now, but the earth will outlive her children. Spring water boils the quinoa. Winter rain pounds the window. I nap with the cat. Beautiful shelter cat finds wonderful home. In the zendo, deep meditators, beginners' minds, sit through fire alarms. Beautiful maiden dressed in flowing white with acne cries. Soft moonlight illuminates those figures. New moonlight reflects new times. New moon foreshadows light ahead. Community service worker in the park doing time. The stove Buddha sits still. Resting under the shady tree, birds greet me. Cool shade, hot summer day, ants march along in unison. The birth tub empty stories to tell. In my next life, let me be a change maker for the better. All around the house, cat fights, crickets sing, deer frolic, hummingbirds flutter, butterflies in love, bird song, firefly lights up the dark, while inside we chop garlic, carry water. 9 years in a meditation cave, breathe in, beginner's mind. Monks in a mountain temple, winter morning meditation, non-attachment. Dear Bodhisattva, what is your original nature? Sutra scriptures, past, present, future. No way. The way is now. All right. Thank you for listening to all my Zen poems. I hope I didn't read them too fast.
No, I liked those. Can you tell us, before you launch into the other stuff, can you tell us how you happened to make the transition from your more traditional poetry to Zen poems?
Well, you know, I've actually had them and I've worked on them for a long time. I have a committed practice of yoga and meditation, so I have that type of writing also. I don't always tend to share it, except in really, you know, kind of yogic environments, because I feel like it tends to, I don't want to say bore people, but it's not always the exciting type of poetry that people want to hear in settings and different stuff. So I tend not to share it, but I've been sharing it more just because I've been writing so much of it. But I guess it's the balance that I've reached also just in maturity through, you know, growing and writing. I like to have a balance, you know, just, I enjoy doing both. You know, I don't want to be the Pollyanna all the time, and I don't want to be the political activist all the time. I just try to have a balance of different things, and, you know, it makes writing more fun and interesting, and then sharing it, I have more people to share it with, and so, yeah.
Well, I think that's great, and it's always good to be a whole person. So,
yeah.
Okay. All right. Sorry to interrupt. Please proceed with the others.
Okay. So, how about this one's called The Pledge? And I picked it just for the New American Dream radio show. The Pledge. I pledge allegiance to the lotus flower. From Mother Earth I stand with good intention for peace and justice for all. Ahimsa, but please just stay the fuck off my land, sir. Out of my ovaries and sacred underwear. Time to wash thy temple. Sage the fuck out of here. Clearing the chakras like crazy. Chemtrails and prick sticking poisons. Time to fly, bitch. Time to die into new beginnings. Beginner's mind again. Now again. Leafy greens with liberty and justice for all. But please leave no trace. Okay, so this one I also picked out especially for the New American Dream. And it's called Real Change. Shh. Don't scare the white people. Don't disrupt their happy little lives with white sugary pies and lies like God and protein and fluoride. And oh my, how do we take it sometimes in the land of the not-so-free, lost souls on pills, coke kills, ball thrills, toxic shock chills, awed over bills, from remote control gas and shit on cable, telecom taps, Google spying, Abel and Cain babble, two Bible-thumping dicks that just can't get along. I mean, can't we all just get along? Beyond borders, disorders, fears, and new world orders. For peace and justice, social democracy, responsibly conscious, pure harmony, real freedom, and the land of the free
and home of the brave, revolutionary change makers of society. So again, that one's called Real Change.
Probably time for one or two more.
Okay. I did want to just say that I again wanted to thank you and Mike for having me on the show and for your tireless work and efforts to always bring fresh stuff. And I know it's not easy to have a radio show and to keep up every week. And, you know, it's a commitment. And I just want to thank you both for your work and for all the work that you do.
Well, thank you, Abba. You know, it's really a highlight of each week. I hope Mike feels the same way. I know that, you know, for me, this is just something I look forward to.
I always try to tune in, and I appreciate when you send it out on Facebook and the emails, because it's always it's a reminder. You know, in California, we're a couple hours earlier, so it's nice to have those reminders. And I know when both of you send them, it's good.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah. This one is called... Okay, this one's called Jump Ship. Okay. Yes, please, go fuck yourself, because I'm not doing it anymore in these days of slaves and junkies on doctors and pills and so much for thrills on Social Security and TV sets washing brains into factory drains, blood rape, farms of slave burgers, mazes of plantations, cows and prisons for the homeless, boneless white meat, wandering, squandering veins and pipelines for junk and high bills for heat and cable spewing King Dick for profits, heroes and losses, touchdowns and field goals sold and matching shirts and suits, uniforms for slave shops, humiliation military. Just pull yourself up from your cardboard box strap. Like they say, time to jump off the slave ship and really live. Do we have some musical accompaniment?
Operation Mockingbird, how the CIA played America like a mighty Wurlitzer. The man behind Operation Mockingbird was Frank Wisner. In the late 1940s, he established this group aimed at both domestic and foreign media. The program was remarkably effective. According to the book by Davis, by the early 1950s, Wisner owned respected members of the New York Times, Newsweek, CBS, and other communication vehicles. Wisner's Mockingbird was referred to as the Mighty Wurlitzer, as it could make different sounds with different modulations when called for. Just those we know of, a few of them, Steinem, Matheson, Buckley, Woodward, as well as William Paley of the Columbia Broadcasting System, Henry Lucci of Time Incorporated, Arthur Hayes Sulzberger of the New York Times, Barry Bingham Sr. of the Louisville Courier Journal, and James Copley of the Copley News Services. Now the editor of a major German newspaper says he planted stories for the CIA. Dr. Udo Ufkot said he accepted news stories written and given to him by the CIA and published them under his own name. Ufkot said the aim of much of the deception was to drive nations to war. Why would it ever end? Anderson Cooper, John Stewart, Brian Williams, Matt Lauer, Dan Rather, Walter Cronkite, Paul Harvey, Jennifer Johnson in your hometown, the Mighty Wurlitzer, Operation Mockingbird. Why would it ever end? Ever. Ever end.
Yes. And now we return to the continuing saga of Behind Enemy Lines. Tommy sits with his grandfather's ham radio on the old wooden workbench, a fire in the stove flickering. Tommy leans on two legs of the old chair to get close enough to see in the low light to fine-tune the old beast. Fuzzy, humming reception. Outside, something walks past the garage, sucking mud. The rain patters on the ancient roof. A drip, drip pops the concrete somewhere in the dark, like a resistance fighter in France or Prague or the hills of South Dakota. Tommy huddles in the garage. The radio cracks, hums, buzzes like it wants to talk. Tommy wears the old leather headset, holds the rusty microphone to his mouth, pops a Cheeto into his mouth, and drops one to Buddy at his feet. What a time to be alive. Bigfoot, conspiracies, UFOs, the vortex of human existence, the apex, the nadir. He sucks on another Cheeto. Time is growing short. The fire pops, crackles along with the radio. The wind whips, the rain pounds. Tommy! The resistance fighter hears his mother and dashes for the door. Stay tuned next week for another episode of Behind Enemy Lines, when we will hear Tommy talking to Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, Geronimo, Leonard Peltier, Bobby Sands, Nelson Mandela, Huey Newton, Fred Hampton, Kevin Barrett, Joe Hill, Emma Goldman, Dorothy Day, David Gilbert, Daniel Berrigan, Lucy Parsons, Helen Woodson, Gary Webb, Frank Cordero, Bobby Kennedy, Lori Berenson, Marilyn Buck, and Malcolm X in a conference call. Behind Enemy Lines. Now it's time for, sponsored by Undercover Dutch Ovens of Dubuque. Another episode of Outside Job. Last week we saw Wally taking the roof rake to clean the snow off and making lewd comments about Irma through the storm window. And even though Irma couldn't hear what he was saying, she could just about imagine. And now we're here at the February thaw celebration in Ice Lake. It's cold outside, cold weather, cold air, wood, not enough wood, get some wood. We see fireworks exploding in the crystal air in the image of Vladimir Putin with a fake mustache, beard, and horns. We smell wood smoke, cedar, mixed with moose poop, and old leather finished whiskey. We feel our toes just barely as if they're leaving us. And in the high school theater named after local hero Joseph Cotton, a crowd is gathering for the opening of the new play written by local writer H.R. Puffinstuff. The local play nominated for something or other. You'll never know what you'll do until you do what you do when it's cold. Stage right. Action! If you'll look out your window, you'll see playing again in all theaters, E.T., the extraterrestrial. It's the 1980s again. Walmart has a book sale in the cat food aisle. Hunt for Red October, Red Storm Rising. There are duck and cover billboards littering the highways, and Hollywood celebrities warned us during the recent Oscar Awards not to eat snow. Michelle Obama and Mrs. Biden, whatever her name is, both have new beehive hairdos in an attempt to take the country back to the future. It's the Cold War all over again. The Manchurian Candidate, House Un-American Activities Committee, the Catholic Legion of Decency, the Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals, Dr. Strangelove, Red Dawn. In his closing statement at the Olympic Games, Vladimir Putin said, "Mr. Obama, tear down that wall," pointing directly at the Arizona-Mexico border. Tom Clancy, James Bond, Octopussy, the man with the golden gun, the man from Uncle, Rocky and Bullwinkle Show, I Spy, Bobby Fischer and Boris Spassky. It's all there in boxes, in the closet, in the basement, all ready to break open again. George H.W. Bush made sure there was no peace dividend when the Berlin Wall came down, and now we know why. Barbie dolls, the perfect symbol of the American zeitgeist, are now selling like hotcakes. And this time we're really going to beat them to the moon. NASA has announced plans to send a dog and a monkey and Toby Keith on an exploratory mission to Grosse Pointe, Michigan next Wednesday. We now know from our study of the First Cold War that the FBI set up a surveillance operation in Hollywood, made efforts to pinpoint and blacklist communists, secretly laundered intelligence through HUAC, and further helped in producing movies that fostered the FBI image as the protector of the American people. The FBI additionally endorsed films, including Oscar winners. Well, thanks to Project Mockingbird, Bill Clinton, the Bushes, and Barack Obama, we won't have to go to too much trouble to retool. And as we heard our beloved president in his national radio message yesterday, as he accepted his Nobel Peace Prize a second time, stage left, "My fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes." Stage center. Cue the sun. Dancing hunters come on stage from left and right. Spotlight on the lead singers in the Duck Blind. All cast comes on stage to sing the closing song. "You'll never know what you'll do until you do what you do when it's cold, when it's cold."
Our next guest of the evening is Sherwood Ross. Sherwood Ross, just like Abba Bird, has been with us practically from the start of this show, going back to February of 2011. And Sherwood joins us each month, the first week of each month, from Coral Gables, Florida. Sherwood is a legendary newspaper reporter, what I would call a real newspaper reporter. He started his career, I think, at the Chicago News Service, which many reporters of that day and age did. He went on to join the Civil Rights Movement. He's written poetry. I believe he's written novels. He's an award-winning poet. And Chuck will be getting Sherwood on the line just about now. Sherwood knew Martin Luther King. He is a national treasure that we're proud to be able to have with us every month. Hello.
Hello, Sherwood. It's Chuck Gregory and Mike Palachek and the New American Dream Radio Show.
Hi, Chuck and Mike. How you doing?
We're real good. You know, Mike reminded me that this is our fourth anniversary show, and you were on the very first one. So we're glad to have you back each and every week, and especially right here on the fourth anniversary show.
Well, that's great, and I'm honored to be part of your effort to bring social justice to the American public. I think what you're doing is really important. In my neighborhood, I live in Little Havana in Miami, where tens of thousands of Cubans have taken refuge. So it has become the foremost stopping place for Cubans dispossessed. And you know, when President Obama announced his initiative to recognize the Castro regime, there were people here and there in our community who protested bitterly because Raul Castro is a dictator and there are no free elections in Cuba. Well, you know, I think to myself, join the club. Elections are less free in America all the time. Republican legislatures across the South are attempting to roll back the civil rights movement of the 60s. I mean, aren't we becoming another Cuba? The authorities are demanding picture ID cards. They are deliberately creating long ballots, long voting lines. They are knocking former criminals off the voting rolls. They are doing everything they can to keep the poorest of the poor from casting that ballot. So lots of Cubans can't vote is nothing to laugh at because Americans can't vote either. And worse, when they do, the candidates we have to vote for, I mean, they're not worse than the old Southern expression, ain't worth a hound dog's behind. One part of Miami that hasn't changed a bit is what they call historic Overtown. It's historic, all right, ever since the day it fell apart. And a lot of people who live there would prefer to live and send their kids to school in ritzy Coral Gables or South Miami, but they can't get up what Woody Guthrie called the do-re-mi. In fact, minorities all over America are losing economic ground in employment and income, according to a report by the Associated Press this past year. I think to myself when I read this, you know, so what's new? Afro-Americans twice as liable to be unemployed as whites. Heck, it was that way in the 1980s, the 1960s. I remember them saying that in the 1940s. It was labor unions in the 30s, actually, that gave blacks their first big breaks, not the AFL either. It was the CIO that led the way. Well, besides prison, today blacks largely are going nowhere economically. Neither are whites for that matter, but it's even worse for black. The prison system with 2.3 million inmates is a dragon that's swallowing young black men. You know, police departments that can suit up to look like the North Korean military are arresting them in record numbers. And of course, there are the killings by police departments. I mean, doesn't that remind you of the Ku Klux Klan of the olden days? And then the laws, too, are different. You know, a kid in the Milwaukee inner city, black kid, goes to jail for smoking pot. But across the town line in the suburb, the white kid pays a fine and goes to college because they don't have the same kind of laws in white and black neighborhoods in this country. You know, one thing I find that has changed, and I don't like it, is that the spunk and fire has gone out of the American people, black and white, Latin and Asian. The average citizen no longer believes anything good is going to happen. His horizon has been lowered. The U.S. has been in half a dozen wars in recent years, during which the average citizen would really like to see the potholes fixed here at home and not in Iraq after we've blown up the place. But what's President Obama's doing? He is pushing legislation to replace all America's atomic bombs and their delivery systems. And what's that going to cost? He's going to send Mr. and Mrs. America the bill for $1 trillion. And remember, he's the candidate who promised us a nuclear-free future. Man, he talks well. We need a nuclear-free future, and what we've got is the same old military-industrial complex arsenal deluxe that is benefiting the makers of atomic bombs and the guys who design them. And some of those atomic bomb design laboratories, the average salary, it's $180,000, $190,000 a year. It's incredible what the people at Los Alamos in New Mexico and Livermore in California are earning. It's beyond all comprehension. And they are death scientists. That's what they're doing, and they're being paid awfully well for it. So far, President Obama hasn't pushed through a $10 living wage for the average guy, which we need, and the average gal. So the only thing to do, my friends, is to run for Congress yourself. Yes, you. Maybe you've never thought of it, but why not? It just doesn't take money. It takes will and it takes organization. And we've got to reorganize this country from the bottom up anyway. So that's up to you. And it's been a pleasure to talk with you. I would now like to recite a quick poem called Cicero's Error, because what happened in ancient Rome has its counterpart today. Marcus Tullus Cicero, your memory lives with me. What statesman, author in all history has left us your glorious legacy? From 106 to 43 BC, you, using your oratory, condemned the wicked and magnified the just. In your show of fairness, all Rome found a tribune it could trust. You were an honest governor of Sicily, much admired. You rose on the list of public servants. It was said you were carried into Rome on the shoulders of all Italy and followed in the streets by 20,000 youths whose admiration and allegiance you inspired. But when you exposed the five Catilines, plotted the Republic's overthrow, you erred by executing the lot of them without a trial, a tactic your enemies used on you in all too short a while. So died the greatest Roman of them all, the orator who kept his audiences in thrall, the man who quelled the Catiline threat, but who has killed himself like a common brigand, although all of Rome was in his debt. Today, Cicero's error is repeated by President Obama, who killed Anwar al-Awlaki, an American, and his 16-year-old son, Abdul Rahman, without a trial, followed by the murders of a 17-year-old cousin and seven others, actions cloaked in secrecy and thus all the more vile. In the final chapter, the president is not your pal who takes your life without a legal rationale. Hiroshima's bombing shortened World War II but begat a nuclear epic, filling men with fear and rue. proving the quick result is rarely the good it seems, for no good end ever justified or wicked means. I'm Sherwood Ross. Good night to every one of you.
Sherwood, we have a few minutes, so if I could keep you here.
Sure. My pleasure.
That was a lovely poem. I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Can you, I know that you are still very, very active in publicizing various activist people and causes, books.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you've been doing?
Yes. Well, there is an Australian pediatrician by the name of Helen Caldicott, who came to America and was teaching at Harvard when teaching pediatric medicine at Harvard when Three Mile Island blew up, or I should say melted down, whatever it was. She decided that she was going to oppose the nuclear device that was being put around the neck of the people of the world, with the nuclear plant builders building hundreds of these plants like Three Mile Island and like Chernobyl in Russia, like Fukushima in Japan. These places inevitably are going to have accidents or will be the targets of earthquakes or floods or maybe terrorist attacks or just plain ordinary accidents. And there are quite a few of them in these nuclear plants, and they're dangerous. And the residue, what's produced in these plants, the nuclear fuel, is used by the military, nuclear bombs. Well, anyway, there's, so I'm working with the Hildecock Foundation in Asheville, North Carolina, and you could look it up on the internet, which I urge.
And now, from Port Orange, Florida, with stops at Information Clearinghouse, Nation of Change, Truth Out, World News Trust, Intrepid Reports, Dissident Voice, and many others, Phil Ferruggio presents It's the Empire, Stupid!
Good evening, working stiffs. Who needs truth in cartoon America with a K? German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer once wrote, "All truth passes through three stages. A, first it is ridiculed. B, second it is violently opposed. And C, third, it is accepted as being self-evident." The truth is that we are living now and have been for over a century in an empire. Since World War II, it has become a military-industrial empire. The scholars and historians who have been warning us as to this empire are hardly ever, if outright never, allowed in or on the mainstream media. Sadly, if one wishes to know what Professor Chomsky, Dr. Parenti, William Blum, Ralph Nader, Chris Hedges, and many others were arguing against, one must read their books or view them through the alternative media. Now, my cable provider, AT&T Uverse, won't even allow free speech or Link TV, yet they allow a myriad of garbage news talk shows on the air. Our nation has become a cartoon. One surmises that these entire kiddie shows each Saturday and Sunday morning serve a purpose, to get the youngsters acclimated to cartoon America. You see, the masters of this empire have set things up so shrewdly for generations. Their best coup d'etat was only allowing us the choice of the two-party or one-party system of politics. As Ralph Nader so succinctly put it, the choice between twiddle-dum and twiddle-dee. Tune in to BoobTube and watch the cartoon channels CNN, C-SPAN, Fox News, and MSNBC. They offer you the same Republican versus Democrat claptrap each and every day. The cartoon hosts, Sean Hannity, Bill O'Reilly, Rachel Maddow, Al Sharpton, Brian Lamb, and their multitude of talking hacks always make it sound as if the two parties are at war over the hearts and minds of Americans. They throw at you issues like abortion, gay marriage, immigration, and the hottest one of all to the empire, Obamacare, which purposely gave away the store to the private insurance companies. The real dialogue and debate should have been about a Medicare for All system versus private health insurance, which Cartoon America would never broadcast. Every mainstream newspaper, website, and of course, electronic media outlet will never allow readers and viewers to understand what is really ailing America. An empire on steroids. More than half of each of our federal tax dollars goes to military spending. We illegally and immorally invade and occupy sovereign nations, send drones out to destroy innocent civilians, all in the name of fighting terrorism. Yet, our almost 900 foreign military bases in over 100 different countries are never mentioned. Who the hell are we to do such things? Is this not what an empire does? Did not the Romans and the British do the same thing? What happened to their empires? What will happen to ours as the roads and bridges crumble along with our schools and libraries? More and more of our people are forced to fend for themselves in some bizarre form of Darwinism. The box store becomes the number one employer, part-time mostly, in this cartoon America. More and more of us walk around with spaces in our mouths where teeth used to be, because who can afford the $2,500 for a root canal and a crown? The young lady next door to me works three part-time jobs to pay her rent and bills. When will we all reach the Rubicon? Friends, working stiffs, don't read or watch the cartoons that they are sending your way. Mickey Mouse is dead. Thank you.
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Now for your local Earth news. Hello, everyone. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Polacek with a review of today's news from the eye of the hurricane and the eye of the blizzard.
On January 10, United National Anti-War Coalition joined many other major anti-war organizations at a meeting in Washington, D.C., where we planned for several days of action around the date of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. It is time that we are back in the streets in a big way. Please plan to join us, organize buses and carpools, and save the date. For areas that are too far from Washington, D.C., plan your own action in your area. End all wars at home and abroad. Join us. Nashville, Greenland's internship opportunity. 1 year experience in social justice service and action. Begin spring 2015 or when preferred candidate is selected and available. Nashville Greenlands is an intentional residential community devoted to urban agriculture, and social justice action. We have a network of six houses we've restored in a poor neighborhood in Nashville, Tennessee. The internship will consist in working with young residents in four small service and advocacy organizations in which they have key organizing and staffing roles. Nashville Greenland's vegetable and fruit gardening and housing maintenance work at the community yards and houses one day a week. Open Table Nashville outreach and support services to people experiencing homelessness 2 days a week. Workers' Dignity organizes mainly among immigrant workers to recover lost wages in cases of wage theft by unscrupulous employers 1 day a week. Nashville Food Project gathers, prepares, and distributes surplus food for disadvantaged communities and food desert neighborhoods 1 day a week. Work schedules may be adjusted to meet the needs of the organizations and workers involved. Compensation will include free housing and $50 a week personal spending allowance. Application and contacts and relevant background resume and a short personal statement of your interest and motivation to Carl Meyer, Nashville, Greenlands, 2407 Hyman Street, Nashville, Tennessee, 37208. Or Carl Meyer NG, that's KARLMEYERNG at hotmail.com. Phone 615-322-9523. And from the New York Daily News exclusive, 84-year-old activist nun imprisoned in Brooklyn jail hellhole for breaking into a nuclear facility, exposing security flaws. Sister Megan Race and two other activists broke into the facility outside Knoxville, Tennessee in 2012 to bring attention to the dangers of unimpeded nuclear proliferation. Now, Sister Megan lives in horrifying conditions in a single room with 111 other women in the Metropolitan Detention Center. See the New York Daily News for more.
That's all, folks. That's news, and we are out of here. Good night and good luck. And so it goes. Stay classy, San Diego. That's the way it is. Stay on the same page. Take it to the next level. At the end of the day, it is what it is. Have a good day. Bring something to the table, and always remember to tip your congressman. Our next guest of the evening is Mickey Z, Mickey Zezima. Mickey Zezima is a writer and activist in New York City. He lives in Queens, Astoria. Mickey joins us the first week.
All right.
And we're going to have that interview with Mickey right about now.
Once again, it's the beginning of a month, and I welcome my good friend Mickey Z, commentator on the first Thursday of every month. Mickey comes to us from New York City. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chuck. It's a pleasure, as always, to be here.
So what's happening up in the city up there? I bet it's, the weather isn't as nice as down here.
You could say that again. after January, that was cold, but more rain than snow. February has been a typical New York winter, storms and sleet and ice. But always room to turn it into political analysis, because we had the threat of a storm here that did hit other parts of the Northeast pretty hard. So I don't mean to downplay it in any way. But the mayor went on TV and radio and internet and everything saying that this was going to be an historic storm, one we've never seen before, and basically threw this scare into everyone. He shut down the New York City subways that night, which I've lived here my whole life. That's never happened, except parts of it related to Sandy, which, of course, was a whole other story. And then they had essentially a travel ban that the streets were empty. And so what it felt like, it felt almost like a police state exercise that we were being told that we were helpless and the best choice would be obedience and compliance and leave it to the experts. But if you step outside, there'll be, you know, the police out there to make sure that you go back where you belong. And I feel like, you know, the 1% really never misses an opportunity to reinforce this dynamic. So then the storm came and went, and as I said, I lived in New York my whole life. It was pretty much your typical New York City winter storm. It wasn't pleasant, but the next day everybody was up and out and doing their thing and laughing, saying, oh, what a joke that it didn't happen. But I couldn't help but wonder if, you know, about a society that's so willing to surrender, basically delegate its freedom and independent thought to the powers that be.
Well, you know, that's quite interesting. One of the people in the choir where I sing was a day late coming home from New York because the airports were closed.
Yep.
Same
yep.
Stuff.
And now, I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I understand or am in a position to say when and how flights should be canceled, but this preemptive aspect of something might happen, it has like this whole 1984-ish thing to it in the sense that we know what's going to happen. You guys are irresponsible and don't know. So for your own good, we're shutting everything down. And for the people who don't like it, we do have a heavily militarized police force on the street to make sure that you start to like it. And so, of course, there are circumstances where you people shouldn't be out driving unless it was the absolute emergency, and planes shouldn't be taking off under certain circumstances. But this concept of preemptively doing it, I found disturbing.
Well, I think it's very disturbing, and it almost seems like it's a practice operation for something more sinister.
Yeah, it lays the groundwork that it's almost a test on their part to see how we respond. And essentially, everyone just shrugged it off. You know, in fact, like that afternoon, when it became apparent that the city was about to go into shutdown mode, right here in the neighborhood that I live in, Astoria, Queens, if you went into a supermarket, it was a frenzy in there. People were acting, you know, as if, you know, we were coming up on Armageddon. The shelves were empty, people fighting in the aisles to get water and like 20 days worth of supplies. And I feel like we all responded like programmed drones in the sense that we did everything. Like we panicked when they told us. We ran home and locked the doors and isolated ourselves when they told us. And we were fine with the idea that, you know, trains weren't running, planes weren't running because it's for our own good. And that sounds familiar. That's what we get. You ask people, do you feel uncomfortable with losing freedoms at the airport? And many times they answer, well, it's for our own good. And I think we need to be a little bit more critical in our thinking than that.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. You know, the run on stores and things like that, that happens down here every time that there's an announcement of a hurricane. And this whole type of thing, this disaster-based scenario is something that the government manipulates. I firmly believe they manipulate it to control us.
With the help from the corporate-owned media, because if there's one thing the corporate-owned media are geniuses at, that's using public relations and programming and conditioning to turn an independent-minded populace into a consumer base. And so in this case, what we're consuming is this other, like you said, this disaster, this story that there are things beyond we can't handle. It's beyond our means, and that's why, fortunate for us, there's these experts and these well-armed men on the streets who can take care of this. You know, it's sort of like, it reminded me of a scene from A Few Good Men with Jack Nicholson, says something like that, like, you know, you need us there at the borders, and it's as long as we believe that, we just continue to surrender power to them.
Well, pretty soon there won't be much power left for us to surrender.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think you're right.
Well, aside from that, what's happening in the city?
Well, because of the inclement weather, there has been a little bit of a lull in street activities, but I do know that there's a lot of stuff in the works. And last time we spoke a lot about the Black Lives Matter movement. It's still alive and well. it's not the most, I admire the fact that the organizers within that movement recognize that it's not the most effective thing to be out on slushy, icy streets doing protests, because there's really no outreach to be done there. If anything, you come across as some out of touch zealot doing that. And there's a lot of plans in the works, and I anticipate that as we head towards spring, that this could be a really, really active time, not just in New York City, but across the country and around the world. I spoke with some people on a radio show called Project Censored, and they were based in Northern California, and they were saying they were seeing the same thing there, that the cohesiveness from coast to coast that's been spawned by Black Lives Matter is a source of inspiration, because it seems like this could be the most important movement because of how diverse it is. So even though right now things seem to be a little bit out of pause in New York, I feel confident that even by the next time you and I speak, that things will have kicked in.
Well, that's going to be interesting to see how that turns out. I'm planning this Friday to go to a workshop presented by Rivera Sun, the activist from Taos. And
yeah.
He's doing a workshop, which he's doing a little Florida tour. She's done, four or five cities. And Friday's the one in Coral Springs near here, and I plan to see that. It's a workshop on activism for peace.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's important and is going to workshops where you're face-to-face, and this is, again, the topic that you and I have discussed about, is really the foundation of keeping these movements going. We need to exploit the power of social media and the Internet, of course, to keep the momentum and to get the word out there and to connect as broadly and internationally as possible. But without that foundation in each and every city, where people know each other by names and they see each other on a regular basis and they do things like go to workshops, the pattern has repeated itself over and over and over in movements, especially in the Internet age, that if we're not connecting as human beings face-to-face, it's difficult to maintain that connection. And it's easy to then have fractures and schisms that are based on Internet interactions, which, of course, you can't discern personality and tone and so on the same way you could as if you were physically in the room with people. So I think it's really important that we find that blend. So I'm excited to hear that you're doing that. And I hope that that's something that is popping up everywhere, that we're getting where we're connecting on the web, but then we're going face to face and doing things like workshops and organizing meetings and potlucks and things like that.
Well, yeah, I'd like to see a lot more of that happening. So. It's funny, until this last year or so, I really had not gone to workshops, gone out of the house to do this stuff for many, many years. I mean, I used to be very active in the 60s and 70s, but then I guess I got apathetic, and I didn't do it. But now I'm...
How does it make you feel doing it now?
More alive. It makes me feel like, maybe I can make a difference. Maybe I'm not invisible. Yeah.
And at some point, I just wrote an article that went up on World News Trust today that talks about the obstacles of activism and how sometimes when we don't get results, we're brought together by a common cause, which is often our anger at some injustice. And then if we don't get results as fast as we might have expected, we have all that anger and we sometimes aim it at each other. Or, like you said, we just go back home and just say, I can't deal with this. And I end the article with a quote that I can only paraphrase right now from the great journalist I.S. Stone, where he says something along the lines of, if you expect to see the full results of your work during your lifetime, you just haven't asked a big enough question. And I think that if people could have that sense of selflessness, that we're doing this for not just future human generations, but for the entire ecosystem and all life that lives on it, that whatever steps we take now, we may not necessarily reap the rewards of it, but it pretty much is now or never. We really need to create change because the stakes have never been higher.
Well, I think you're 100% right there. And on that note, we're going to have to wrap things up.
Okay.
Do you want to remind the listeners where they can find your book?
Yeah, my latest book is called Occupy This Book, Mickey Z on Activism. It has its own Facebook page with that exact name, Occupy This Book, Mickey Z on Activism. It's available on Amazon. In a print copy, if you prefer ebook version, you can get it at a site called Kobo, K-O-B-O. Or just basically look for me on the web, on all the typical social medias, WordPress, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, et cetera, and you'll find information about the book there. And reach out and connect. I'd love to hear from people.
Well, I'd also like to remind listeners, Mickey's written a lot of great books, including one called No Innocent Bystanders a few years ago that I published with CWG Press. And you ought to check out all of his books. They're really good.
Absolutely, and I still appreciate that. Thank you, Chuck.
Thanks again, and I'll talk to you next month.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure. Have a good one.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
It's always a pleasure to talk to Mickey Z. Really glad to have him on the show. And as I mentioned at the end of the interview there, he has written a lot of great books. And if you happen to get up to the New York City area, be sure to see if you can see him live. I know I would really like to see him live. Maybe we can convince him to come down to South Florida.
His enthusiasm is amazing, I think, he's very optimistic, and he can talk on any topic. I think he's really, we're really lucky to have him on the show.
That's exactly right, Mike.
Have you ever been to New York?
Oh, I've been to New York many times, but
oh, have you really?
Not for many years, yeah.
And now for another episode of The Lives of the Cowboys. From last week, stay clear, focused, fat, and stupid. The colonel led his men in their morning mantra and then held out a box of red Twizzlers for Duke and Bubba Steve and the others to dig into on their way out the door. Hit the streets and be careful out there, boys. Information is everywhere, I'm afraid. But hey, wait. The colonel stopped them to hand them the new updated face sheet from Homeland Security and Walmart on ISIS and how they are coming over here, and they will probably be here soon, maybe later today, and this could pretty much be it, is kind of the deal. So, said the colonel, holding the door for Duke, Bubba, Steve, and the other officers. They stared at the open door in the street and Mrs. Thomas clutching her purse to her chest on her way to the post office. Go on, said the colonel, taking his boot and his knee to shove them all out the door. Get. And this week, we find Duke and Bubba Steve sitting in the squad car on the curb, staring straight ahead, eating popcorn, on homecoming parade duty. The crowd pushed up tight to the streets. The day was bright and blue. The bands marched past. The team floated past on a flatbed. And then... Bubba Steve grabbed for the radio mic and dropped it. His eyes were wide. Duke choked on his popcorn. It was happening. Coming straight down Main Street was a float, a big black float, the Deathmobile. Standing on the front of the float in a pirate bandana, pirate shirt, pirate pants, and pirate sword was John Belushi. He ripped off his shirt and displayed a white T-shirt with pizza stains and ISIS written across the chest in pencil. Ramming speed, shouted Belushi, pointing his sword at Duke and Bubba Steve in the cruiser. Duke turned the key and pumped the gas. Bubba Steve tossed his popcorn out the window. The Deathmobile loomed large, closing in on them, headed straight for the cruiser. ISIS coming right at them at ramming speed, and they were sitting in the squad car in just their white underwear, their worstest ever nightmare yet. Right out in front of everybody, Duke and Bubba Steve's moms and dads and brothers, sisters, girlfriends, teachers, Isis Belushi, the second cousin of Al and Bob Qaeda, trying to take over the world, and he had to go through Duke and Bubba Steve to do it. Stay tuned next week for another episode of The Lives of the Cowboys, sponsored by Twizzlers, when we will hear Duke say, Allah Akbar, and we will hear Bubba Steve say, I know, right? The Lives of the Cowboys, sponsored by Twizzlers.
And now, a message in a Boone's Farm bottle. Some notes we've been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegraph. We hear from Phil in Shadow, Pennsylvania. You don't need to be a Georgetown graduate of the Diplomatic Killing Corps or a rocket scientist or some overpaid pig of entertainment journalism or a pundit or a war hero or a black president or a member of a publishing class to understand what bombing Syria and Iraq and any other country means to the military and civilian murder machine. Below, just the facts, man. Clearly laid out as the direct military profiteers engaged in killing people abroad or in their neck of the woods, as in Israel, you know, all those companies that are the GEs and Boeings of the world. But do not be misled. Americans and Westerners make their livings directly and indirectly killing people. All those defense manufacturers also run on secretarial pools, CPAs, worker bees, the little Eichmanns, web designers, PR firms, all the nuts and bolts and fabricated metals. You think Intel is some benign outfit? Amazon.kill, Google, IBM, HP, the works. Hell, even Hollywood makes money on murder. Had plenty of people who work at Intel who would one day like to do something else. But for now, top secret marketing, designing hardware and software that ends up in tanks, on drones, and nuclear subs, guided missile guts, etc. Don't forget that much of this murder hardware is designed and conjured up by the best and brightest at our Western colleges. Lawyers abound in this industry. Unions love good Boeing missile-making jobs. This is the legacy of killing empire. A black president who isn't and is fabricated by the same crap schools and teachers who also advance murder, economic hits, or direct hits with drones and napalm or guided bunker busters. The horror is right, Kurtz. Horror indeed. We can go on and on about boogeymen and lies and more lies and false flags and lefties who are really hawks. All that, sure. But just look at this gear, this most dirty of industries that has co-opted hundreds of other industries and employs millions upon millions of little Eichmanns for a job, to raise a good Jewish or Christian family, to retire and travel and live the top 20% consumer lifestyle. Makes you want to kiss the feet of nuns and ministers and lay people who've been busted for protesting Minutemen and outside the murder joints of the U.S. Armed Forces. Just kiss them and cry for them as they rot in jails for civility and humanity, while the pigs all the way through the little Eichmann species laugh and cultivate more murder, coming to your local military police hardware fire sale soon. Sales for the world's 100th largest arms producers amounted to $411 billion in 2010, according to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. The top seven U.S. arms producers are also among Uncle Sam's 10 biggest contractors. Number 10, United Technology Sectors, aircraft, electronics, engines. Arms sales in 2010, $11.4 billion, and total employment, 208,220. Number 6, Raytheon. Electronics, missiles. Arms sales in 2010, $23 billion. Total employment, 72,400. Number 5, General Dynamics. sectors: artillery, electronics, military vehicles, small arms, vessels. Arms sales in 2010, 23.9 billion. Arms sales as percent of total, 75%. Total employment, 90,000. Number four, Northrop Grumman. Sectors: aircraft, electronics, missiles, vessels. Arms sales in 2010, 28.2 billion. Total sales in 2010, 34.8 billion. Arms sales as percent of total, 81%. Total employment, 117,100. Number three, Boeing. Sectors: aircraft, electronics, missiles. Arms sales in 2010, 31.4 billion. Total sales in 2010, 64.3 billion. So arms sales are 49% of their total. Total employment, 160,500. And number one, Lockheed Martin. Sectors: aircraft, electronics, missiles, space. Arms sales in 2010, 35.7 billion. Total sales, 45.8 billion. Arms sales as percent of total, 78%. Total employment, 132,000.
A message in a Boone's Farm bottle. Some notes I've been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegraph.
And now, your 6 o'clock news moment of Zen. Close your eyes and imagine John Stewart, Stephen Colbert, Brian Williams, Peter Jennings, Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Matt Lauer, Rachel Maddow, telling the truth. Breathe in. Breathe out.
A very angry Senator John McCain denounced Code Pink activists as low-life scum for holding up signs reading "Arrest Kissinger for War Crimes" and dangling handcuffs next to Henry Kissinger's head during a Senate hearing on January 29th. McCain called the demonstration disgraceful, outrageous, and despicable, accused the protesters of physically intimidating Kissinger, and apologized profusely to his friend for this deeply troubling incident. But if Senator McCain was really concerned about physical intimidation, perhaps he should have conjured up the memory of the gentle Chilean singer-songwriter Victor Jara. After Kissinger facilitated the September 11th, 1973 coup against Salvador Allende that brought the ruthless Augusto Pinochet to power, Victor Jara and 5,000 others were rounded up in Chile's National Stadium. Jara's hands were smashed and his nails torn off. The sadistic guards then ordered him to play his guitar. Jara was later found dumped on the street, his dead body riddled with gunshot wounds and signs of torture, despite warnings by senior U.S. officials that thousands of Chileans were being tortured and slaughtered. Then Secretary of State Kissinger told Pinochet, "You did a great service to the West in overthrowing Allende." Rather than calling peaceful protesters despicable, perhaps Senator McCain should have used that term to describe Kissinger's role in the brutal 1975 Indonesian invasion of East Timor, which took place just hours after Kissinger and President Ford visited Indonesia. They had given the Indonesian strongman the U.S. green light and the weapons for an invasion that led to a 25-year occupation in which over 100,000 soldiers and civilians were killed or starved to death. The U.N.'s Commission for Reception, Truth, and Reconciliation in East Timor stated that U.S. political and military support were fundamental to the Indonesian invasion and occupation of East Timor. If McCain could stomach it, he could have read the report by the U.N. Commission on Human Rights describing the horrific consequences of that invasion. It includes gang rape of female detainees following periods of prolonged sexual torture, placing women in tanks of water for prolonged periods, including submerging their heads before being raped, the use of snakes to instill terror during sexual torture, and the mutilation of women's sexual organs, including insertion of batteries into vaginas, and burning nipples and genitals with cigarettes. Talk about physical intimidation, Senator McCain. You might think that McCain, who suffered in Vietnam, might be more sensitive to Kissinger's role in prolonging that war. From 69 to 73, it was Kissinger, along with President Nixon, who oversaw the slaughter in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, killing perhaps 1 million during this period. He gave the order for the secret bombing of Cambodia. Kissinger is heard on tape saying, Nixon wants a massive bombing campaign in Cambodia. He doesn't want to hear anything about it. It's an order to be done. Anything that flies or anything that moves. Senator McCain could have taken the easy route by simply reading the meticulously researched book by the late Christopher Hitchens, The Trial of Henry Kissinger. Writing as a prosecutor before an international court of law, Hitchens skewers Kissinger for ordering or sanctioning the destruction of civilian populations, the assassination of unfriendly politicians, and the kidnapping and disappearance of soldiers, journalists, and clerics who got in his way. He holds Kissinger responsible for war crimes that range from the deliberate mass killings of civilian populations in Indochina to collusion in mass murder and assassination in Bangladesh, the overthrow of the democratically elected government in Chile, and the incitement and enabling of genocide in East Timor. McCain could also have perused the warrant issued by French Judge Robert Leloir to have Kissinger appear before his court. When the French served Kissinger with summons in 2001 at the Ritz Hotel in Paris, Kissinger fled the country. More indictments followed from Spain, Argentina, Uruguay, even a civil suit in Washington, D.C. Hitchens was disgusted by the way Henry Kissinger was treated as a respected statesman. He would have been appalled by Senator McCain's obsequious attitude. Kissinger should have the door shut in his face by every decent person and should be shamed, ostracized, and excluded, Hitchens said. No more dinners in his honor, no more respectful audiences for his absurdly overpriced public appearances, no more smirking photographs with hostesses and celebrities, no more soliciting of his worthless opinions by sycophantic editors and producers. Rather than fawning on him, Hitchens suggested, why don't you arrest him? Hitchens' words were lost on Senator McCain, who preferred fawning to accountability. That's where Code Pink comes in. If we can't get Kissinger before a court of law, at least we can show with words and banners that there are Americans who remember, Americans who empathize with the man's many victims, Americans who have a conscience. While McCain called us disgraceful, what is really disgraceful is the Senate calling in a tired old war criminal to testify about global challenges and the U.S. national security strategy. After horribly tragic failed wars, not just in Vietnam, but over the last decade in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's time for U.S. leaders like John McCain to bring in fresh faces and fresh ideas. We owe it to the next generation that will be cleaning up the bloody legacy left behind by Kissinger for years to come.
Your 6 o'clock news moment of Zen. Close your eyes and imagine John Stewart, Stephen Colbert, Brian Williams, Peter Jennings, Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Matt Lauer, Rachel Maddow, telling the truth. Breathe in. Breathe out.
Well, it's been another long week in Duluth, Minnesota, my hometown, at the end of the empire. Duluth is a microbrew of what is going on everywhere where the people fight to have some sort of say and leave it to the outlaws to come up with something. Leave it to the guys in the jails and carrying skateboards, leaning up against the light pole at 2 in the morning to come up with something. It's the home of Piker McNugget, Carol Kopecky, Frosty Pine, Winnie Bloodfeather, some 23 Toivonens, Diamond Griffin, and Penny Jones. Families from Minneapolis and St. Paul and St. Peter and Mankato and Des Moines thundering up Interstate 35, hit full throttle on Friday afternoon, accelerating past Hinckley and Sandstone, past Pine City, Barnum Cloquet to get away, to let their hair down, to get bugs and branches in their hair. You turn your phone to vibrate or heave it into the ditch, grenade style. Change your radio from WCCO to the Moose. Duluth is big burritos and apricot wheat beer and a parade to celebrate cold weather. Duluth can be murder. It's the big lake, big woods, big tradition, big old buildings. Like an old sailor headed back to his boat at 4 in the morning, stumbling, never falling. It's the sauna and the secrets of the North Woods. It's schools on top of bars, on top of bait shops. And it's adventure. And it's being able to be yourself. but Duluth can be murder. It's the trains, the taconite, guns, tattoos, bowling brawls, Bigfoot, and ball games. It's laser tag. It's the bomb. It's the goal. We continue our story, the inauguration parade for Mayor Mary Pine, and watching the parade, Penny Jones. Penny Jones was going to kill the new liberal mayor, but it seems someone got there before him. Penny climbed onto the flatbed and finds himself the one helping her as she struggles for life. He was busy with one of his first aid classes, and then we found him in the cabaret bar. Penny was nursing his beard, thinking about practically everything in the whole universe there is to even think about. And who would know that? Who the hell would even care what Penny thinks or feels? And now, we meet Billy.
He felt bad. The badness in his stomach pulled his head down. They all do the right things. He does not do the right things. They deserve to be happy. He does not deserve to be happy. Being happy is all there is. Nothing else matters. He can never get there because of what he's done. It's beyond him forever. It's on the other side of the thick glass, and it's too thick, and they can't even see him over here or even look. Who are they? What have they done besides being handed money and something to do and someone to be? They're the visitors to the zoo that gets to go home and out to buy ice cream. He has to stay. If he were rich, he might feel a little better. He raised his head, saw out on the water a wonderful red ship that needed him. He jiggled his willies, and he felt the burn in his cheek when the breeze blew. Cold, cold, bold, stole, gold. Global warming would get here last of anywhere. Way up there, he saw it all, felt everything. The smoke going up from that stack on that building, the white froth on the edge of the water, the hum of the tires on the pavement below, an iron chair banging on the playground equipment, a million feet stomping snow on the rubber mat, heading into the warm school with teachers right there, smiling, collecting hats and coats and gloves. And smiling for real, not like you were in big, big trouble. Cold. The billboard for skiing at Spit Mountain up there. The pounding of his heart and the snot dripping onto his lip. He licked it. Cold. Leaving somebody behind, especially if it's a little kid. Cold is so cool. It's golden. It's precious. You have to save it because it won't always be here. Cold is sick. It's dying, just like me. He jiggle-wiggled while he sat. He felt the knot on his throat and put his hands back to rest. He was finally there. Here. Now it would happen. This. He rubbed the hard, rugged rock. This is where it would begin, the final battle, the battle between good and evil, right and wrong. The only question was what side he was on. He looked out to the water. It sat gray and boring and depressing, except for the big, long, red boat, ship, whatever. Billy sat back on his hands looking for winter. He looked to the left and saw the big bridge. A siren howled somewhere and Billy ducked like a pheasant in the grass. Could be a fire, but could be the police. Way out over the water, the clouds hunkered low and dark and moved this way. It was a big storm. And way, way out past even that, smoke zigged up from the trees. Probably a big forest fire headed his way, and he would have to save the people. The waves chopped, and even from way up there on the hillside, Billy the Kid could see the dead people bobbing from back in olden times. He jiggled his willies, his toes. It's even in his toes. Winter is coming. It comes here first of everywhere. Billy tugged his red ball cap down tight and tried to zip his blue and red jacket and let it drop. The zipper did not work. Just like everyone anybody ever got in a Christmas clothing drive. Again, he touched the knot at his throat, holding the red towel cape. He jiggle-juggled and he sat. He juggled his toes inside his bleached white socks, the dull ink M-A-R on the toes, going round and round like a stuck film loop. Around and around, and it showed that he was thinking hard, catching and tossing all his thoughts, working. He spied his fingernails and tore at one, nervous, knowing that if he thought of the right thought, it would sizzle like a spark in the prairie, like on that one show they watched at his last placement or two placements ago. He pulled one foot up, then the other, and ripped his socks off and burned it down. He stretched out his feet and put them right together and pushed all his toes as close together as they would go and then went on thinking. So he was careful, but his toes spun like crazy when he wasn't looking. It's coming. He stretched out his feet in the coarse, dry grass and let his weight go back on his hands on the big rock. He stretched out his feet on the coarse, dry grass and let his weight go back on his hands on the big rock.
And that's the news from Duluth, where all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats and journalists are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
And that wraps up another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We thank you for joining us tonight, and on this our fourth anniversary show. We hope you'll be back next week and every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Good night to my friend.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, sir. Good night to my friends Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. And so, good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Emily Parker. Good night, Ben Wheeler. Good night, Crystal Campbell. Good night, Nancy Lanza. Good night, James Foley and Stephen Sotloff. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.